Welcome to the 44th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist living in Southwest Florida. I'm also an endurance athlete training for marathon and Ironman's upcoming this, or Iron Distance races, I should say. It's not a truly sanctioned Ironman race this fall. I have a marathon in Morgantown, West Virginia, an Iron Distance race in Wilmington, North Carolina, the Marine Corps Marathon and the Sacramento Marathon on the books for this fall. So training is amping up. I bring this podcast to my listeners to help educate people about the benefits of a whole foods, plant-based, low-oil diet. I practice this at home. My family does. I teach nutrition classes in my office. We just finished the third six-week nutrition course in the office. It was a great success. I'm proud to say that every nutrition course that I've done has seen more success and a higher percentage of students ending the course fully plant-based. Numerous people have lost a significant amount of weight, joints feeling better, cholesterol improved. The last day of the class, I typically do a little group test to see just how much people have retained, and questions like, you know, that they can, again, entertain at a dinner table and with their friends, and, you know, how to go about and kind of defend themselves in the world of omnivores, such as where do you get your protein, your omega-3s, you know, what's a favorite plant-based meal that they've had, if they've learned in the course. I bring food and do some cooking in class. So, you know, a lot of them have enjoyed that. One student even brought some no-added oil cookies that were really, really good. We also talked about, you know, how to travel both by car and by airplane and eat plant-based, eat good whole foods, plant-based nutrition, the importance of taking a B12 supplement, how to eat out with friends, how to menu plan, how to shop at a grocery store and explore new things. This last week we had seitan burgers, and I served them with peppers and onions, and it was the first time most of them have had seitan, and they did like it. It's a nice texture. That was input from Vincenzo, the co-host cat. So they enjoyed the plant-based hamburgers, and so we had a good time with the discussion. I think the next class starts September the 2nd. We might actually be expanding into two separate classes as opposed to just one class per six-week period. The other thing that I think we're going to do is to have graduation or graduate meetups so that anybody that's taken the nutrition class that want to come to a potluck once a month, I think we're going to start that. So if you have taken my nutrition class and you're interested, please go to drdelaney.com and sign up for the newsletter or watch for when those dates occur, or give us a call at the office and we'll certainly keep you informed of when they start. I think I have most of the people's emails, so we're ready to go. Today's guest is a PhD candidate from the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. She's a nutritional epidemiology PhD candidate. She has a master's in public health in nutrition from Johns Hopkins. She has her undergraduate degree from Cornell in psychology, and she was an executive director for the T. Colin Campbell Foundation. She's a very young and energetic PhD candidate. She's also started a wonderful website called plantbasedresearch.org. I would encourage you to check it out. She has cataloged numerous scientific articles. She's also has a little pamphlet on how to interpret scientific studies. You know, so much, especially on the internet, there's so many different sources of information, and people quote articles all the time that, you know, this improves that and this decreases the mortality by so many percentage. And she gives a little synopsis on just how to interpret some of these statistics. You know, oftentimes they'll say that there's this great reduction when there's a really small study and it might account for one or two people over a several year period. So, you know, you have to be really careful when you're looking at, you know, things on the internet and studies that people claim as, you know, great benefits, and really see how the studies were designed, who they, you know, how long a period, how many people, you know, what kind of questionnaires. Nutritional studies are very difficult to do, just because you rely on the subject's ability to recall what they ate a lot of times. And in studies that look at people's recollection of what they eat, it's very inaccurate. It's just human nature. We just don't remember what we eat, especially in today's age when things are moving so quickly. So, you know, a lot of those studies can, you know, have a lot of inaccuracies. The other thing is some studies, you know, if you take the standard American diet, it's so poor, and you just improve on it a little bit, you may see some great benefits just in the short run. You know, any weight loss study is going to improve short-term outcomes, but do they last? And, you know, what impact does that have on the long range? So you have to be really careful when you're interpreting studies. So I would urge you to look at her website. You know, again, that's plantbasednutrition.org. You know, again, with Dr. McGregor, he has nutritionfacts.org is also a really great website to look at for, you know, research studies, and he does a great review. But back to Michaela Carlson, she, again, has cataloged a lot of these studies, and some of the interesting ones that I looked at just briefly, looking at osteoarthritis. Oftentimes I've mentioned that, you know, people go on a plant-based diet, their joints pain goes away. And, you know, most people think, you know, you get old, you get arthritis, and there's nothing you can do about it, and your joints are supposed to ache, and you're supposed to be creaky. But going on a plant-based diet, a lot of people, especially eliminating dairy up front, have a much marked decrease in their joint aches and muscle aches. And a lot of that has to do with the animal protein and the arachidonic acid that's found in animal food. When you decrease the decrease in prostaglandins are what causes pain in the joints, so that, you know, by eating less animal products, you're having a decrease in inflammation. Also by eating, you know, more plants, you're clearing a lot of toxins, more nutrients, and so people do well. When you eat animal protein, a lot of times that protein is not completely degraded into amino acids, and you get bacterial uptake in the gut because of small intestine permeability. You get immune complex formation against those proteins, and those immune complex are large protein molecules that can lodge in capillaries that feed small joints blood flow, which causes accumulation and damage over time, and chronic inflammation. So that all leads to arthritis. So by decreasing, you know, the animal products or animal protein, you can strongly improve that. The other thing that they looked at was, you know, just looking at weight loss. It's sad to say that there are a lot of joint replacements in people that are significantly overweight that, you know, perhaps are done prematurely, and certainly people get a lot less benefit from them if they are they're still overweight after they've had their joint replacement. You know, the more adipose you have on the thighs and the less muscle mass, it causes joint malalignment, and so you replace a knee and then the hips are malaligned. You know, I've heard and seen, you know, people comment, you know, that their hip wasn't put in right or their knee wasn't put in right. But think about the process, that if your hip joint is so deep down under a lot of adipose, and the process, you can go on the internet and look at the process of a joint replacement, getting everything aligned is, you know, virtually a miracle if the person is really large. And so the mechanics of that are going to be altered, and it's going to be, you know, almost impossible to have a joint that was like the original equipment 20 years ago. So it's certainly not a miracle procedure. But if you lose 4 pounds, for instance, the mechanical load on the knee can be, the way it goes is every pound that you lose of weight, you have a 4 pound decrease in the mechanical load on your knee during daily activity. So, you know, 20 pound weight loss would be an 80 pound reduction in the mechanical load. So you can see just by some, you know, a 20 pound weight loss, if you're overweight, can really, really help decrease your knee pain. And they actually did, there's actually a study cited that just by a 15 pound weight loss, there was 50% reduction in knee pain in a group studied, you know, by, you know, their assessment of different joints in the pain. So, you know, it's really worthwhile if you have arthritis to decrease your animal protein consumption and get the weight off to really improve your function. Then you can move around more and life is a lot better. The other thing that they looked, other study that I briefly looked at was, you know, women on a low-fat diet decreases their estrogen by 15 to 50% in 2 to 3 weeks, which is huge as far as decreasing breast cancer reduction, decreasing hot flash symptoms in post-perimenopausal women. So, you know, there's tons of benefits by becoming plant-based. And again, check out that website, which is plantbasednutrition.org. So without further ado, I think we're going to go on to the interview, and I'll catch back up with you later. Welcome, Michaela Carlson. Michaela is a fellow at Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. She has worked as executive director for the T. Colin Campbell Foundation in the clinical study program, for which I took the course, and I guess she was there at the time, so that's something interesting that we'll talk about. But Michaela, you've been plant-based for several years, and now a lot of your research is sort of directed at epidemiology involving nutrition, and particularly plant-based. Is that so?
That's correct. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm currently a doctoral fellow in the PhD program at Tufts in the nutritional epidemiology program. And so I'm still in training, but I've been fortunate enough to be part of actually a new survey that we just launched in the last month on popular diets that we're still recruiting for. And I'm really looking forward to continuing in a research track in the next, you know, few decades.
And you've also started the plantbasedresearch.org website, which you, it's a wonderful website, and I'll make sure I link it to the show notes, where people can look at research articles on various dietary interventions and also learn how to understand research, which is part of the problem these days. There's so much information out there, people don't know what to do.
Definitely, yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I started the website because when I worked for Dr. Campbell and the foundation, I encountered so many people that I think as interest in nutrition grows, interest in research and nutrition research particularly also grows. And I think a lot of people were and are very excited about the idea of research and getting more kind of involved in evidence-based thinking and really appreciating drawing conclusions based on scientific evidence. But I think many people, even with that enthusiasm, didn't necessarily know how to find original peer-reviewed research papers themselves. They didn't know where to look necessarily. And then even if they do know, I mean, the most obvious, like the biggest database, one of the biggest databases is PubMed, as you, I'm sure, know, and many people do use. But even if they know to look there's so much in there that it's really hard to wade through all the search results that come up. So I created the plantbasedresearch.org website as a library, and I wanted really to make research on plant-based nutrition, the original sources of that information, more accessible to the public. And then I also wanted to sort of create an online narrative review so that people who were involved in research in some capacity would have an easier time finding papers, and then hopefully that will affect them and their interest in possibly doing research in this area, plant-based nutrition.
So as you said, you're in the beginning of your career. I listened to your interview with Howard Jacobson, and I kind of chuckled as far as, you know, he said he was cynical, and you said, well, you were young, and, and I kind of laughed, and it's like, well, I'm not going to go down that road with her, but you you became plant-based college, high school?
Yeah, I started, I think I stopped eating meat in high school. I didn't really like meat, and I did have a kind of unformed feeling that I wanted to be healthier, so I guess my intuition and some of my friends were vegetarian led me down that path. But I did go to Cornell, so I encountered Dr. Campbell when he was still teaching at Cornell while I was a student there. And I became essentially a vegan eater in college, like in my early 20s. And I did read the China Study as soon as it came out, but that wasn't actually until after I had graduated. So I didn't have the opportunity to take his class, but my best friend at the time, Megan Murphy, did, and I already ate a vegetarian diet, essentially, so I kind of got the lowdown from her about all this information about protein and cancer and Dr. Campbell's work in turning cancer promotion on and off and what he was sharing in his vegetarian nutrition class. So by the end of that time, I was eating a vegan diet. And then actually I moved to France for a year, and I was nanny for a French family, and I was not able to maintain a vegan diet there. But as soon as I came back, I, you know, got rid of all the cheese and eggs and immediately felt a lot better. And I've kind of since that time been refining my diet further and further to be more whole food, plant-based, and not just vegan.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Not a lot of young people think about what they're eating, you know. You're young and invincible, and like you say, no, really, you know, unless you've had major health problems, most people don't think about it. And you know, as a younger person, and most people think that they can out exercise, maybe a little bit of junk food diet. So as long as everything's, you know, okay, then, you know, eat what you want. And there's a lot of, you know, bragging rights to, you know, the big pizza and the Blizzard and all that kind of stuff as a college.
That's true. Yeah. And I mean, I'm not, I still feel like a young person. I'm 35, but I actually am noticing, I don't remember what other people were eating when I was in high school or college. I remember what I was eating. And since that time, I've certainly created a community around me of friends who eat in similar ways and have similar values. But I am shocked when I'm around. So I have a friend here in Boston who is a campus tutor. She's a residential tutor at one of the universities in the city. And I've sometimes eaten dinner with her in the dining hall there. And so I have watched what these college-age students, so they are around 20 or early 20s, I guess, are eating. And I feel like it's so much worse than even when I was in high school or college, which now is only like 10 or 15 years ago. And I don't know if that's just because I've forgotten what people are doing. I don't know. But I feel like even in my own personal life, I can see our diets getting worse and worse. And it's very disturbing. I mean, I'm sure that you encounter really poor diets all the time, but you're also a doctor seeing people who are ill. And I think I've just felt quite shocked recently when I've noticed kind of what kids and teenagers and young adults are eating, because it's atrocious. Like, I just think it's actually getting a lot worse.
Yeah, and the other part of it is, I don't know if, and it's another area that I would be interested as far as the research go into it, but, you know, I'm a endurance athlete, so I do marathons, Ironman, so to speak, and, you know, when you go in those, there's a healthy subset of people that do those. And there's also a set of people's like, well, if you're exercising 18 to 20 hours a week, you can pretty much eat as many calories of pretty much anything you want. Mm-hmm. And so I see the population, especially more, maybe more in the marathons, because once you get to the Ironman, it's a little bit more serious as far as athletics go. But, you know, a lot of marathoners, I'll get back in shape to do a marathon. You know, people in their, say, 30s, 40s, and they're significantly overweight, and they're hoping that the training is going to fix everything, but they continue to eat a horrible diet and, you know, almost, it's almost, you know, so to speak, run to eat. And I find it very, I find it very disturbing, you know, that, because I think it's a little bit scary as far as the health, The potential complications from pushing your body, but having such poor nutrition and being overweight. And, you know, again, it's always comes back to, well, you know, you run, so you're going to hurt your joints. Well, you're certainly going to hurt your joints if you're, you know, 60 pounds overweight and doing all that.
Right. Yeah. Do you see a lot of patients in your practice who are serious athletes, but have poor diets like that?
No, that's the beauty of it. For the most part, I don't see very many athletes. And I see the beginning. I see people that are wanting to become the midlife athletes. But the once okay. the people have, you know, most of my triathlon marathon circle, they're actually pretty health conscious and, you know, that they're doing all right. So, and I've never seen somebody, you know, I've never seen anybody with atrial fibrillation induced by, you know, endurance athlete. I've never seen, you know, an MI with, you know, the triathlon or marathon patient, you know, so, but I have seen a few that, you know, are going the other way, trying to get back into doing something like that.
So,
you know, one thing I encounter that's, you know, and we talked a little just briefly before we started, is the shock and awe of introducing a plant-based diet to people. What's your research experience how well do you think people are informed that particular diet is available to them?
Well, I guess I can say that I should just preface this by saying, like, I'm really interested in the concept of adherence and what helps people stick with a diet or change their dietary behavior. But I'm still in training, so I'm learning about this now, and I'm actually hoping to study this question as part of my thesis research. But I wouldn't pass myself off as an expert yet, hopefully one day. So having said that, there are a few surveys on the barriers to eating a plant-based diet, and some of those refer to a more totally plant-based diet, and some of them are undefined, and so the people answering those questions might interpret that as a diet that includes a lot of vegetables and fruit, but not necessarily a vegetarian type of diet. But one of the top barriers that people identify is a lack of knowledge and concern about getting enough nutrients. So I think that even though this is such a growing movement and so many people are eating plant-based or vegan or vegetarian even, I think for the majority of the Western world anyway, we still have a concern with getting enough of nutrients and particularly protein, and considering that protein, people think of protein as synonymous with meat. So I feel like people actually, even though, I mean, I am in touch with so many people eating a plant-based diet and enjoying that very much, I feel like it's still quite unusual for people to know that that is an option for them, and especially for disease reversal, that's even more unusual. But I feel like a lot of people just don't really, they don't encounter that or consider it. I mean, but you're kind of delivering that news, it sounds like, to people for the first time, for many of them. And what do you think about that question?
Well, I am. I'm completely, I've been amazed. I would say virtually 100% of the people that I bring it up with, you know, the people that I meet for the first time, have never heard about nutrition as playing a role in their disease. Most people are very much, it's genetics, it's something that I have, I inherited, you get when you get older. Everybody has high blood pressure, it's just, you know, an aging process, and there's no way to turn it around. You know, you control these things with medicine, don't worry about it. You take the pills and you'll be okay. It's just one of those things. That's almost universal. And as far as just being a plant-based diet, you know, a lot of people have heard the vegan word, you know, and there's not a lot of positive around it a lot of times. So I kind of go in through the plant-based door. you know, and try to, you know, and I try to go through the positive aspect of what you can eat, because it, you know, the first thing is I can't give up meat or dairy, and I can only eat celery and lettuce, you know, that.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know.
And the thing is that, like for so many of those people, if they just for many of them, if they just ate more, a little more celery and lettuce and didn't change anything else, that would probably be an improvement compared to what they're eating.
Or
so
just
even if they...
I'm sorry. Yeah, or just to get people to cook. You know, in Florida, again, it's a little bit different because it's... you know, there's a bit of a retirement type area, and but even the young people that I see, nobody cooks anymore. So it's hard to get nutritious food at chain restaurants.
It's really hard. It's really, I think that facilitating people cooking at home is the number one most important strategy to ensuring that you can actually eat healthy food. Because even if you live, I mean, best case scenario, you live in New York City or somewhere in California that has meal delivery service. Like, I know that Forks Over Knives recently launched a meal delivery service in New York City, and I don't know, they might have launched it in California already. Or, you know, you could hire a personal chef to bring you food or cook for you or something. But barring that, which most people can't take advantage of those things, like, the number one most important thing is to cook at home, because when you eat out, the food isn't as fresh. You can't control the oil and all the salt they add to it. And there's just so few options that are really, truly healthy out there.
Yeah. I've found that that's, you know, even when I do a nutrition course that has 6 classes, and one of the classes, we actually go to the grocery store and we actually go through the produce aisle and then, you know, do some label reading other places. But a lot of people just don't have any idea what to do with the stuff. And so I started bringing some dishes in that we make, because that's the other thing. I took pictures of what I ate, and, you know, and I showed that to people, and they's like, oh, I could eat that. That looks pretty good. And then I took it. The next step was, okay, I brought the food in for them to taste. And then now I'm actually cooking some while they're there, just to, it's like, okay. Cause I always tell people, it's like, I can get this on the table in 30 minutes when I get home from work. And, but they have to see it, and they have to see it done to make it look like it's not so scary.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That hands-on demonstration is really critical for people that are encountering this for the first time. Like, well, I think a lot of people just can't picture it until they see it.
I interviewed Paul Shapiro last week, who's the vice president of the Humane Society, and they actually have a rollout campaign to, you know, reintroduce Meatless Monday and Go Green Days to institution, hospitals, universities, and where they come in and they actually bring a how-to guide all the way from, this is what you buy, this is how, you know, this is what it costs, this is how you promote it, and this is the menu, and this is the recipe. And I think that, you know, introducing to these, you know, especially university campuses and then, you know, hospitals where the food is traditionally poor. But we were talking about compliance. And, you know, I brought it to him. I think that in addition to, you know, knowing how to cook and being exposed and that it's going to be pleasurable, I think if people have another reason, you know, a little bit about, you know, well, the compassion towards animals or the environment, that you have another... I guess another reinforcer to keep doing it, as opposed to this will just help your health, because we all know things that'll help our health, but, you know, it's like, okay, I should go to the gym, or I should run, or I should, you know, I shouldn't eat sugar, but it's hard to stay on that, plan, and people often fall off.
Yeah, it is hard. I think the other thing is, I mean, consistently in research on behavior change and dietary change and weight loss, the factor of social support is really important. And when people, even when they're motivated and they have a lot of reasons to do this diet, if they don't have a community of other people eating the same way, it can be very, very hard to continue. And even, I think, really, for people to reach out to the friends and family that they're close to and explain what they're doing is important. It's an important first step. But those people may or may not want to eat the same way, and that's fine. But also, like, for a lot of people who don't live physically near a lot of other plant-based eaters, I think social media is a really key element in creating a sustainable lifestyle from it, because you have to have connection with people where eating that way is normal and you both just enjoy it. I mean, social support is identified as important, but especially for this, because you have to choose to do something differently, and like that can be a point of disconnection that you feel. I think a lot of people who are more successful really seek out those social groups and those opportunities to connect with people that do eat the diet. And I don't know if you like feel that way about your patients, or if you are able to connect them with each other, but I think a lot of these support groups and meetup groups and potlucks, it's like, I think it actually plays a really important role in being able to sustain a lifestyle.
Yes, I'm actually one of the directors of a meetup group. It's called the Charlotte County Plant-Based Foodies.
And oh, nice. That's so awesome. I really think what you're doing then, that is a critical element for so many people that would otherwise feel alienated because of this lifestyle. And there's no replacement for that, because it's just so wonderful to eat and share plant-based food with people that also want to be eating it.
Yeah, it's been a great group. It's very interesting to watch the dynamics of it. There are a lot of people that come that are plant curious, but again, it's a place that they can go and ask questions and not be judged. But we actually did try to do a book club review one month, and we decided to review Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease by Dr. Esselstyn, and a lot of people came and a lot of people brought the book, but like three people had read it. And, so I do think, the support, I think that's huge. And I see people down here, especially, like they'll say, well, that's one of the things they'll say in the office. They'll say, well, our friends won't want to go out with us, or we won't be invited to cocktail parties. Mm-hmm. And I kind of giggle to myself, because it's almost like, back in high school that I won't be socially accepted, but I guess it's just a human quality that we want to be socially accepted and people want to be near people.
Yeah. It's a human quality. We all want that. And I think that if we don't acknowledge that and take steps to make sure that we do get it, that's when we're setting ourselves up to discontinue and to not be able to stick with it.
Yeah, I followed Dr. Esselstyn's role when I signed people up for the nutrition class in the office. We do two for one as far as the spouse goes, because I want the spouse to come.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
Because
that's,
I think that
so
if the spouse doesn't come, then, you're kind of, or especially if the cook doesn't come, then you're kind of doomed.
Yeah, then you are doomed.
The funny part about it is that when I'm presenting, and a lot of times I'll do this initial presentation right at the bedside in the hospital. I get consulted on somebody that's had a heart attack or that has chest pain. And mm-hmm. So the wife will be in the room, or the husband, whoever the spouse is in the room, and I'll start in on my little plant-based, nutrition mini lecture. And mm-hmm. I can see the color drain out of people's faces.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure, then I'll maybe change the approach a little bit. And I'm not sure. Sometimes I think that the cook is becoming irritated because they're going to have to change.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I'm dead wrong as far as I had a patient. Well, the first patient was the husband. And I uh-huh. started giving my little plant-based talk, and I could see the color drain out of her face, his wife's face, who was uh-huh. sitting there, and she looked angry. And I thought, I'm probably never going to see these people again in my life, because they're going to, as soon as they can get out of here, they're going to, never
they're
come
gonna
and see
run away.
Me. But I still felt like they were young, and I needed to give it my best effort. And
yeah.
So I did, and I didn't hear back from him, but a few weeks ago, I heard from her. And she actually uh-huh. came in and had problems, and I told her, I said, I thought I really, made you angry when I spoke. She said, oh, no, you didn't. You should. I just, it was just the shock and all of it, and how she was, she was going over in her mind how she was going to pull it off,
Wow. That's so awesome. I'm so inspired to hear you talk about that, because, you are, as a physician, you're on the front lines of really changing people's health with food. Like, that is so inspiring to me.
It's revitalized my practice. I'm 53, and so I've been doing this for a long time, and you see the same things day in and day out, very little variations on the theme, and you really don't make a whole lot of progress. You just kind of patch people up. But yeah. I've had, and it's actually more and more, and the successes are getting closer and closer together. And it really makes you feel good when you can take people mm-hmm. off their medications and their yeah. pain goes away and their arthritis goes away and they start feeling good.
Yeah. There's nothing better than feeling good. You know, that's what we all want.
Yeah. And it's a win because I think, you know, typically what happens with the traditional patient that say has to have a bypass is they have a bypass. It's a life changing experience. They're scared to death. They've looked death mm-hmm. in the eye and they'll do anything for 6 weeks. And after 6 weeks, right. once the pain goes away and they're back on their feet, then they start falling right back into their old habits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's frustrating. It's not enough to have that initial scare for many people. It's enough to stick with it for 6 weeks, but when it comes to sticking with it for the rest of your life, it's not always enough.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, the scare tactics, you know, that doesn't work, you know, at all. They've got I think Dr. Doug Lyle, I'm familiar with his book, The Pleasure Trap. You know, yeah. He talks about, you know, we all want pleasure. We all want to be happy. And the thought of taking something away, you know, I'm going to take away your hamburger and replace it with a carrot stick. It's just not going to make it, you know? You got to see it as it's a positive thing. Not only just the health benefits, but you know, it's like, okay, this is actually going to taste good and I'm going to enjoy this and I can be social with it and you know, I can still have fun.
Yeah. Yeah, like I think making it an enjoyable lifestyle is what could make it successful for people because my interpretation of the research on adherence to medication, like statins, as I'm sure you know, there's a high rate of discontinuation of statins. And I think that the immediate experience that people are having when they take medications or when they try to exercise coming out of being out of shape is that it's very burdensome. It's either inconvenient or it's actually painful maybe, or it's just an annoyance and they're not necessarily feeling better from taking the pill or taking the medication or doing the exercise. Whereas when you make a more radical change with a plant-based diet, you do actually feel better. So that can be at least one element of feeling motivated to continue. That I think that is a sort of distinction between a lot of these other health behaviors that have been studied and eating plant-based as opposed to simply like cutting out soda or making more minor changes that are good changes but don't necessarily produce that more robust difference in your energy and how you feel on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. So when you're doing your research at Tufts and you're gathering people from various diets, I presume right now it's kind of on the forefront mm-hmm. here and to see how things work out. Where do the patients yeah. come from? Or is it something you're advertising through social media and the newspapers yeah. or magazines?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, we've done all of the research survey that's open right now is called ADAPT. For adhering to dietary approaches for personal taste. And it's been open since mid-July, and we have, depending on when you get this podcast posted, there'll be probably another week left, so we're leaving it open. We're planning to leave it open through the end of August and then doing a soft close, so we'll probably stop advertising it and then not seek out any more new participants. But we're seeking people from all different dietary backgrounds and really the widest span possible of dietary patterns. So that includes very high carbohydrate, like whole food, plant-based, very low fat, all the way up through different patterns like Mediterranean or gluten-free or whole food or locavore, and then low-carb and paleo and you know, high protein diets. And we're trying to get all of these people to participate in the survey. And then the hope is that in the future, different researchers at Tufts will be able to recruit from this pool of people with a much wider range of macronutrient composition than currently exists. And a lot of the scientists there are very excited about the project. And the great thing about it, and for me, one of my thesis aims is the question of what predicts adherence. And I think that even though a lot of these people eat very differently from each other, what they do share in common is that they all eat very differently from the mainstream food environment. And so they all probably need to be making specific choices or using strategies to maintain their eating pattern in the context of this modern food environment that's so challenging. So I think even though they eat differently, they probably share some similar qualities that allow them to stick with the diet over the long term. And that's what I'm really interested in, because I think there's some research on adherence and dietary adherence and habit formation. I'm particularly interested in habit formation, but it's still pretty new. And so I think there's still a lot to investigate to see how people free living in the real world are able to navigate the modern food environment and what helps them stick with it over the long term.
It almost, you know, it brings up the team concept to me. You know, everybody wants to be on a team, so to speak. You know, you have your favorite football, baseball, whatever team, you know, your favorite state, your favorite whatever. And I think that a lot of people, you know, identifying with a certain team, the paleo team, the plant-based team, the vegan team, the South Beach team, I think, you know, especially if they've had some success, I think that people can adopt that and become very passionate about their team.
Certainly, yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, that'll be interesting to see, you know, what we can gain for it and what, you know, what, how you can focus to try to get people to maintain their dietary changes. If you look,
I don't mean to cut you off.
Please go ahead.
Well, I think that even though, like, I eat a particular way and I have my own interests about what I want to eat, at the same time, the truth is, the mainstream modern American diet is so poor that there are a variety of other ways that you could eat that would be an improvement. And so, although I have my own specific background and my own specific kind of dietary intentions and my own lifestyle, I do think that there's a lot of common ground among these different eating patterns that can be very valuable for everybody. So I am really interested in looking at that and trying to contribute to that body of knowledge.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting. What about your experience with the education of, you know, physicians? We know in medical school, there's not a lot of nutrition. And matter of fact, when I was in medical school, in the 1800s, there was a class. It was actually an epidemiology course that was really part. That was the nutrition course as well, and you know, it basically talked about vitamin deficiencies and things of yesteryear, but nothing, you know, on how people should eat. And so, I mean, and I think that's fairly standard. There are some schools that are starting to, you know, have more nutrition courses, and there's some push to get those in. But, you know, okay, so the rest of us doctors out here in private, you know, when I'm alone in my town as far as recommending a plant-based diet. And how, you know, how you educate people, you know, how do you get to them? How do you make them want to add that into their practice?
Yeah, well, so you're asking about how, well, first of all, going back to the question of education, I think that one of my best friends actually is a pre-med advisor, and she worked at Cornell for a number of years doing pre-med advising to the pre-meds there, and now has a private advising practice. But she actually told me that a few years ago when she was leaving, the Cornell pre-med nutrition majors actually had a 100% acceptance rate at med school, which is that's a phenomenal number, because Cornell is a good school, and overall, the average acceptance rate among their pre-meds across all majors is around 60%, I think. And don't quote me on, well, I'm not 100% sure about that number, but So I think that's indicative of the interest in nutrition as a skill set and as a background to inform the practice of medicine. But it also seems like medical schools have such packed curriculums that even the ones that would like to add in more, because there are some schools now that have something of a training program, or at least more than a couple hours, but it just seems like they have so little time to add in more classes. So that seems difficult. But then anyway, for what you were getting to about influencing your colleagues and sharing that with them, I don't know. I think that it depends on the person, perhaps. If you're talking about an individual and you can bring it up in conversation and say, oh, you know, I'm so happy I've been getting such great results with my patients using nutrition, and it's possible that a natural kind of conversation could spark something for them. But it's also probably effective to organize events where you have somebody come and talk and really share their experience with their patients or research. And then a public talk seems like it can often have less personal pressure for somebody to have a reaction. They can kind of process it in their own time and mull it over and chew on it. I don't know. What do you think? What do you find has worked with your colleagues?
That's actually a really good idea. It's nothing's worked really well for me at this stage. A few here and there, I've got some interest, mainly doctor's lounge discussions, so to speak. But I think that that's probably a good idea, is to, you know, maybe, you know, try to organize an event. I'm making inroads slowly. I actually have one of the surgeons going to come to my nutrition class. So I'm hoping maybe I can, start to one by one slowly infiltrate a little bit, hopefully.
Yeah, and maybe, like, if you're offering a service to them that they don't have the bandwidth to offer to their patients, like, they might have, even if they don't know about plant-based nutrition, they might have a vague idea in the back of their mind that it would be nice to offer a nutrition class to their patients, but maybe they don't have any staff or they have no time to do that. And so maybe reaching out to people and offering them a service that you have kind of at the ready that they don't have the capacity to offer might be a way to, like, rope them in a little bit. And if they came to your class, they would see what you're saying. And then if their patients are interested in adopting it, they might start to see some results. I feel like for a lot of physicians who eat plant-based and use that in their practice, they started eating that way first and then wanted to share that because they knew that it would work. But I also know there are some people who saw the results in patients first, and then because of that, they changed on their own. And they are, like, that is a really powerful force of a person to be a doctor, because they didn't necessarily care until they saw what it could do. But then, you know, it must be such a different experience for you to be able to really cure somebody versus just patch up their symptoms. And, you know, when you, the difference between really being able to help someone and not really having much to offer and that's permanent.
I don't know. Yeah, very cool. All good food for thought, so to speak.
Well, yeah.
I do really appreciate your taking time to speak with me. I did fill out your survey. I will continue to follow your website.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'll keep following you, and hopefully maybe get you back on here in, you know, a year or 6 months, a year, and see how things are going.
Yeah, I would love that. We are above 10,000 people currently with the survey, so we're hoping to keep going strong through the end of August. So if you'd like to share it with your patients, your friends, your colleagues, anyone, we would be very appreciative. I think it's really going to yield some valuable results that will help all of us in maintaining our diet.
Well, I'll do my best to get the word out, and thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much. It was great to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you. Have a great evening.
You too.
Right, bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the podcast with Michaela Carlson. Again, you can find her website at plantbasedresearch.org. You know, she brought up some interesting points, and I'll be interested in seeing what her research brings. you know, in my experience with the nutrition class in office, I do think that it's real important to have a support group, whether it's a meetup group or family or some friends or even online groups that you can look at. And certainly, you know, websites like nutritionfacts.org, now herplantbasedresearch.org, you can find some information that supports your way of life when you become plant-based so that you can discuss it with your friends or your family when they ask, you know, are you trying to kill yourself by eating plant-based and you're not going to be nutritionally adequate? You know, yes, you are, and this is the reason because of it. There's also, you know, a website that I like is One Green Planet. There's recipes every day. Again, the Forks Over Knives website, there's recipes. I'm trying to put up more and more recipes and things that I eat. So, you know, the more you can educate yourself, different podcasts that you can listen to help also to support, you know, and then there's just a whole group of people that are web-based that you can, you know, gain support from as well. I did try a new grain this week. I guess it's not necessarily a new grain. It's green wheat, and it's spelled F-R-E-E-K-A-H and pronounced Farika, I believe. It is a green. It's wheat harvested green, and then it's roasted, and then sun dried, and basically you end up eating the seeds that are roasted. It's a ancient Arabic dish. They often do it with tomatoes and onions and olives. I actually made it, and we just put some vegetables that I had made, that favorite dish I think I've mentioned before, with yellow squash, tomatoes, okra, and some celery, and we put that over the farika, and it was really, really good. It has a different kind of taste, maybe a little bit like barley. It just has a real smooth taste that you can, you know, you could almost eat it plain without anything on it. You know, I always thought that, you know, rice and quinoa, you almost need some sort of, especially in couscous, you need some sort of sauce or vegetables with it. But this you could actually enjoy even plain. It has has a lot of fiber. It has four times the fiber of traditional wheat. It's 16.5 grams of fiber in a 3.5-ounce serving. It's also 12.6 grams of protein, so it's a real good protein source for a meal. You know, rivals that, you know, of beans, basically. And certainly, it basically has the fiber and protein of beans, so it's a great dish. I'm certainly going to be eating it a lot more. I might, there's a dish we had with tomatoes and eggplant and chickpeas. I think it would be good that way. So I'm going to be experimenting with that some more. I also would like to put a plug in for a local restaurant. Again, I live in Southwest Florida. Today I visited a restaurant in Venice, Florida called Evergreen. And they have a lot of vegan options, so it was very nice. A lot of vegan and vegetarian. They had it laid out really nice, what was vegan, what was vegetarian. They had some vegan desserts made out of tofu. So it's always nice to visit a restaurant like that. I spoke with them about maybe bringing our meetup group up there for dinner. So, like I said, it's always nice to find some local restaurants that you know, we can bring our group to. They're not low oil. I talked to the owner's wife about doing some, you know, oil-free dishes. And interestingly, she is diabetic and wasn't really aware of, you know, the benefits of taking oil out of her diet. But she was very receptive. And her husband is in charge of the cooking. So he said that she said he would contact me and so we could work out some, you know, lower oil dishes. I had a beet Reuben there, which was warm beets with sauerkraut on a rye bread. So it was actually a really good dish and some steamed vegetables as a side. And then I had the tofu chocolate mousse, which was really good as a little dessert. So they come in a little scoop. So it was a nice little taste and tasty treat at the end of the meal. So if you live in that area, then I would encourage you to check that restaurant out. If you have any questions for me, please see my website at drdelaney.com. It's DocTorDulaney, or you can email me directly at jamiedelaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. And certainly send me your questions, concerns, ideas for a podcast. That would be great. People that you'd like to hear interviewed, give it a shot. And until next time, remember to exercise and eat your greens, eat your veggies, and get some sunshine.